This podcast is for personal consumption only and may not be proliferated or reproduced in any way without the explicit permission of its author.
I don't actually have a really beautifully scripted paper, so I apologise if I sound like I'm sort of meandering all over the place. As Gaia mentioned, the way in which I became involved in this panel, what I understand to be the reason why Gaia invited me to give a paper, was an encounter that we all had at the Australian Critical Race and Whiteness Studies Conference in Adelaide in 2007. I won't go into the details of that particular conference, but at a number of points I was very shocked and forced to question my complacency on the ability for Indigenous discourses of anti-racism and rights to engage with migrant or ethnic minority discourses of anti-racism, and the extent to which these two different positions were quite often presented as being even antithetical to each other. And so that was the starting point for me to actually think about this paper, which is my sort of preliminary theorising, so I look forward to people's comments, and I think there'll be some interesting feedback from the other panel members as well. So first of all, why did I pick to talk about Indian discourses of belonging and put them in relation to Indigenous discourses? Well, one, I think it's interesting that while there has been a lot of attention paid to the Indian diaspora in many other contexts, there has been relatively little work done on Indian diaspora in Australia, for obvious reasons that it hasn't been a particularly visible minority up until quite recently. But I think linked to that is one of the big criticisms of the applicability of postcolonial studies to Australia has been that it has been there has been a great deal of prominence of the Indian experience in discussions of what postcoloniality actually means, and that that isn't transferable to the context of a settler society like Australia. So I want today to start thinking about if there is no point at which we can talk to each other, or if there is a point at which we can talk to each other, what work needs to be done on both sides? And this kind of leads me to the sort of really basic reason why I picked this topic, which is looking at my own personal implication, looking at the complacency that I had about we are all just post-colonials together, and questioning the extent to which my understanding of the utility of postcolonial studies is actually challenged when we talk about it in the context of Indigenous claims in Australia. So let me actually get round to talking about what I think these discourses of belonging are. I wanted to actually show people an image, but if any of you are interested, if you go away and look at the India Today newspaper, which is the biggest Australian Indian newspaper. On the front page of the website, there is a little section at the bottom dedicated to successful Indians in Australia. And it does a sort of little overview, a profile of different examples of what a success story Indians are in Australia. I think one of the quite common features of Indian migrant discourses of trying to counter racism in many different contexts has been the contribution that Indians make in terms of we are entrepreneurial, we are hardworking, we are not difficult migrants compared to some of those other groups. In the context of the UK, that discourse is often operated to say, look at us, we're different from, say, the Pakistanis or the Bangladeshis, they don't work as hard, they haven't assimilated in the ways that we have. In the context of Australia, one of the things that I have been really fascinated by is, fascinated and horrified, I should say, but that many of the most racist comments I've heard made about Indigenous people have actually come from the mouths of Indians, I know. I mean, admittedly, you know, I'm sure this is a feature of other migrant communities as well, but I can speak particularly about the Indian community. And the comments that usually take two forms. One of, well, we've been oppressed, we've been colonised, we've experienced racism, but look, we've made good, why can't they? And the other aspect is, well, yes, it's terrible what happened to them, but again, we experienced colonisation. It's not for us to take responsibility for Indigenous dispossession in Australia. It wasn't our fault. Now, I think there are a number of problems with this. Of course, the very basic ethical problem of, I don't think, I mean, it's much the same discourse that many Australians and and I experience this every day in the classroom, many white Australians, the excuse that they give for why they don't have to claim responsibility for Aboriginal dispossession of, well, it wasn't me that did it, certainly there has to be some sort of moral obligation on the part of anybody who is actually living here and gaining some benefit from being here to recognise that it is done at the cost of somebody else. So, I mean, that's kind of a basic ethical reason. The other reason why I think that this is actually a really counterproductive discourse is actually a political one. And that is, and this is where I draw really quite heavily on the work of Eva Povinelli, who has written quite a lot about the discussions of white guilt or white reconciliation with Indigenous communities, where Povinelli talks about how this is not just, oh dear, we did something wrong and now we're paying for it, or now we're going to try and pay for it. It's actually a way of reasserting white belonging in this place. And she points to, and I can't quote it for you now, but if people are interested, I can give you this. She quotes an editorial piece in The Australian straight after the Mabo decision, where there was a long discussion about how we must claim responsibility for what happened in the past for Aboriginal people, because this is something that is particular to us as Australians, white Australians, that cannot be understood by outsiders. So by non-white, non-Indigenous people refusing to take any responsibility for the situation of Indigenous Australians, it actually once again reinforces this idea of the Indigenous problem as the white man's burden, while we just sit here on the side being quietly sort of regulated by the politics of multiculturalism. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and it kind of comes through from what Gaia was talking about, is when you actually look at the colonial logics that were employed for different colonised peoples, we have on the one hand the logic of elimination in terms of natives who were considered black and therefore, you know, beyond exploitation even, who were, you know, this dying race that could be just sort of either we could ease their suffering or we could just let them die out and or exterminate them. And then there was also the logic of exploitation. The Indian focus on how we assert our belonging to the Australian nation actually plays directly into the colonial logic of we are an exploitable labour force. We go around, we build wonderful nations in the name of the British Empire. So that's sort of my little deconstruction of Indian discourses of belonging. So in 5 minutes or less. So I wanted to move now to looking at what I think are some of the problematic aspects of discourses of Indigenous belonging. And in particular, I wanted to look at the ways in which particular discourses of authenticity and belonging to a particular territory are potentially deployable in ways that not only do not particularly assist the Indigenous cause, but are potentially counterproductive to other claims to combat racism. So in particular, I'm thinking here of the ways in which this belonging to land is associated with a spiritual connection that exists separate from the colonial settler mentality, which is about exploitation of the land for the purposes of capital. I realise this is always a bit of a sensitive topic because I have to acknowledge that I am not Indigenous and therefore cannot understand and do not claim to understand or to be able to speak for what it is to feel an Indigenous connection with land. But one of the things that does come to mind is, my background is Sikh, and I was actually, as I was listening to some Bhangra music, which is a very popular form of Punjabi music that actually has arisen much more in the diaspora than back at home, or sort of reinterpreted from the back at home. Even the language of home is problematic, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I was listening to a Bhangra song, and a particular line really struck me, where basically it translates as, "There is no other place on this earth like our land, the Punjab." And if anyone knows anything about the ways in which the Sikh diaspora has worked, it has been very much around this struggle for a homeland, in similar ways to, say, Sri Lankan communities that have supported, say, you know, freedom movements within the context of supporting the Tamil Tigers, or other movements such as support for Kashmir, free Kashmir. There are many different examples from even just within the Indian diaspora of how a particular connection with land has been asserted as taking on a mythical significance that is set up as, well, we have this connection to this homeland, which means that we do feel this spiritual connection to somewhere else, but we contribute to this society here And those two things do not need to be working in opposition to each other. I think, so that's one thing that I think we need to be a little bit cautious of, the claim that there is only one way in which a spiritual connection with land is felt. I think that this can be translated in many different contexts. And I'm not at all suggesting that we say, oh, therefore it's all exactly the same. But what I am suggesting is that maybe we need to question a little bit the extent to which particular spiritual connections with land only operate in some contexts and not in others. And this leads me to the other point that I wanted to make. And I was reading a very interesting essay by Francesca Malan, who talks about the need to actually look at the ways in which indigenous claims to land have been constructed around a particular cultural discourse over the course of the last 50 years. And in doing this, Malan makes the point, which I would like to reiterate, that by claiming that this is a construction, does not at all, I mean, this could be read as being very negative and counterproductive for indigenous claims of sovereignty. That is not at all the intention of questioning the constructed nature of this cultural discourse. Certainly there are certain features of lived reality that are reflected in these discourses. It's not my place to question that. But what I do question, and what Malan's essay does very well, is actually identify why it is that indigenous discourses of belonging to land have increasingly concentrated on spiritual cultural connections. And that, I think, ties actually quite closely with what Maria was talking about, is, well, it's the only way in which indigenous sovereignty has ever been actually even remotely accepted within the colonial structure. And so I think particularly of cases like Mabo, Wick, and if any of you are interested, if you look at the Yorta Yorta case, which was a case that was heard through the federal court, the only ways in which indigenous people have been able to make assertions to claim land is when they have been able to show an ongoing traditional cultural connection to that land. And in fact, the Yorta Yorta people's case is a really interesting one, because in that case, Justice Olney actually talks in the federal court, talks about, well, you haven't maintained your traditional practices, there has not been a traditional ownership, and therefore there can be no recognition of your claim to this land. So it's not completely unimaginable that this emphasis on a cultural aspect of connection with land has been partly constructed by a particular political space. There may well be good reasons why we would talk in these terms of actually trying to assert some sort of claim to land in whichever way we can do it. But going back to, as I said, with the discourses of belonging in terms of Indian people, if we resort to only valuing ourselves in the name of ourselves as exploitable labour, so too concentrations on authentic belonging to a particular territory, in the case of indigenous people, I think is potentially detrimental to the indigenous cause, because it cements this idea of indigenous people as only having a right to claim some sort of sovereignty if they have some sort of cultural or spiritual connection that is completely separate from the operation of capitalism and exploitation of land. So that was the point that I wanted to set up in terms of the discourses of belonging on the indigenous side. Of course, the other aspect of claiming authentic belonging to land is the ways in which this particular idea of native belonging is potentially remobilized in very negative ways in terms of migrants. So, I mean, obviously the term native, and I'm trying to think, I mean, there are various people who have actually talked about the ways in which the term native has been deployed in different ways, whether it's, you know, with a sort of pejorative term to talk about the people of a colonized space, or whether it's deployed in colonial metropoles to talk about the indigenous residents of the homeland. I'm thinking particularly of the ways in which the discourse of native belonging and dislocation as a result of migration is being currently deployed in Europe in the context of the British National Party, in the context of the Front National in France, where you have a complete turning on its head of this idea of native dispossession at the cost of, because of these migrants that all come in and take our land, where suddenly it is the white British that are the victims of these hordes that are coming in and taking from us what is rightfully ours. Now, it may be that there is no responsibility on Indigenous people in Australia to be mindful of whether or not their discourse gets completely reimagined and negatively used in other contexts. But I think one of the other, I think when you look at the context of Australia, if we look at the ways in which this idea of who belongs here and who is coming in and taking resources is actually used, it's used quite effectively by white power to actually say, we are protecting what is ours. I mean, the Howard thing of we will decide who comes here and the conditions in which they come is actually an example. It's not that the Indigenous people are able to say, well, we were here first and therefore we get to say who comes and who doesn't. And an interesting example of that is in an essay by Katrina Elder and a few others talking about how the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in 2002 actually issued a statement where they said that they would grant refugee status to all of the Woomera detainees. Mm. I mean, that's a very interesting example of an assertion of, well, we have the right to say who comes here and we say you can come. But obviously that was a very marginalised expression of sovereignty. I mean, the people who actually get to decide that and say who stays here and who doesn't are not Indigenous people. And also, I don't think that by replacing one sovereign power who has the right to say who comes here and who doesn't with another sovereign power who says who comes here and who doesn't actually addresses the very problematic idea of who gets to belong and who has to constantly be asking for permission to enter. When you look at, for example, I mean, just within the Indian diaspora in Australia, many of the people who have come here have experienced the very real dangers of a nativist discourse being deployed against them. You think of the Indians who have fled Fiji in the aftermath of all of the violence, where very clearly an idea of Indigenous belonging is used to completely destabilise and delegitimise Indian belonging in Fiji, despite the fact that they were also part of a colonial structure where they were moved as part of the workings of the British Empire, and they don't have a home to go back to. And equally, there are many Indians here who have come from former colonies in East Africa. So again, if you look at somewhere like Uganda, another example of where the assertion of native belonging has actually worked to the detriment of other colonized peoples, and I don't think that this is particularly productive. The other point that I wanted to make with this setting up of opposition between we who authentically belong and you who are all settlers is the tendency to completely flatten the different power relations between white settlers and recent migrants. I don't think it's particularly effective to talk about, well, we rightfully belong and everybody else who comes here is actually a form of coloniser. Certainly, as I said before, and this is something that I sort of take issue with particularly in some of Eileen Morton Robinson's work, where she starts off talking about all migrants are settlers, and then she moves to talk only about the experience of British migrants. It's a very different experience of power to be a non-white migrant in Australia as opposed to a British migrant in Australia. And I think that there needs to be some recognition of the difference there. And the final point that I wanted to make on this problem of authenticity of belonging is the extent to which this authentic belonging or authentic Indigenousness is actually used to the detriment of Indigenous peoples existing in Australia. When you think about the number of people who are no longer living on their country, and while Eileen Morton Robinson talks about this in terms of, well, we can still feel a sense of commonality because we have this ontological connection with land, the reality, when you actually look at the ways in which Indigenous claims get contested for particular pieces of land, is that it is not a completely seamless relationship between those who have been displaced or moved, forcibly moved from their original country into another, and those who have stayed put. And again, Eva Povinelli's work, looking at some of the claims that were made under the Aboriginal Land Rights Act, the Northern Territory Act in the 1970s, looking at the ways in which claims were adjudicated, it actually became quite problematic quite often that different Indigenous groups were forced to explain why they weren't to be considered as migrants because they didn't originally come from that particular area of land where another person could claim a greater connection with that land. So when we look at the fact that over 50% of the Indigenous population now in Australia is not living on their traditional land and are not fulfilling traditional lifestyles, it is not a particularly helpful discourse, I don't think, anymore to talk purely in terms of indigeneity as related to authentic belonging to a particular territory. Okay, so where does that lead me? Well, one of the things that really struck me... Sorry, how much longer do I have?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Great. So now I've got to wrap it all up. In saying this, one of the things that I was really struck by at the ACRAWSA conference was the very real criticism posed by Indigenous scholars of the attempts to use post-colonial theory to apply to the Australian context in a way that actually replayed a different type of power relation of, oh, well, look at us, you know, me, the post-colonial subject, oh, I've learnt all this stuff and developed all this theory, and now I can blanket apply it to you as if I'm going to teach you how to be post-colonial. I think when I talk about the ways in which I think there can be debate and discourse between the between Indigenous claims to combating colonial legacies or ongoing colonial experiences of colonialism and talking about, say, Indian community experiences, I'm increasingly being made aware that there is a need within post-colonial studies to actually challenge its own assumptions about what the post-colonial experience involves. And I think that this hasn't... I think that many of the critiques that Indigenous people have put forward are actually very important in reimagining what post-colonial studies can actually do, what is its potential, if there is any political potential left in it. And that is something that I think that post-colonial studies as a whole has not been very engaged with. And there are three things that I think can actually really be beneficial to the development of post-colonial studies as a theoretical framework that Indigenous engagement can offer. One is the debate that's happened in Australia, of course, has been around the extent to which policies of multiculturalism should or should not include Indigenous Australians. Now, understandably, Indigenous Australians have often asserted that it is completely antithetical to the Indigenous cause to be counted as just another ethnic minority. And actually, one of the very productive things that Indigenous activism has done has been to call back into question this hidden issue of race that gets completely erased in debates around multiculturalism. But what I'd like to suggest there is that actually the problem, the solution to this problem is not then to set up multiculturalism as putting us all of us non-Indigenous non-whites together and then Indigenous as separate, but actually what it does is very effectively challenge the kind of colonial mentality that is still very much at play within policies of multiculturalism. So dismantling the politics of multiculturalism, which doesn't just impact on Indigenous relationship with multiculturalism, but actually relates to different ethnic minority communities in Australia's engagement with multiculturalism. The other issue that I think Indigenous scholars have really pointed to in a lot of the language of post-coloniality, of diaspora, of hybridity, is the privileging of movement over those who have stayed put. I think that this is a very valid criticism, and I certainly am cautious that I don't want to reproduce this. But again, I think that actually this is a really interesting opportunity for theories of post-coloniality, diaspora and hybridity to look back at themselves and look at which voices are being excluded, not just in terms of Indigenous peoples in particular contexts, but also in terms of other people elsewhere in the supposedly decolonized world that are also being perhaps ignored or misrepresented by this privileging of the post-colonial elite that moves. And I'm thinking there of some of the criticisms that Gayatri Spivak has put forward for the ways in which the diaspora stands in for the representation of the global south, and the extent to which nice post-colonial elites operate within the circles of the international community as the representation of this is what the global south needs. If I am not in a position to speak on behalf of an Indigenous person, I'm no more in a position to speak on behalf of an Indian woman still sitting in the Punjab. And so I think that this criticism of the ways in which these concepts have been mobilised in post-colonial activism and theory are actually, they go to the heart of the theory. It's not a matter of setting up indigenous issues as separate from other post-colonial issues. And the final point that I wanted to make is, in relation to this, yes, okay, I will sum up. The final point that I wanted to make, that a really powerful critique that I think people like Eileen Morton Robinson make of the notion of post-coloniality is, well, it doesn't apply in the context of Australia because we are not in a state of post-coloniality, that we are actually still living in a colonial period. I think that that's a very powerful critique, but again, I don't think that that is one that is necessarily limited to looking purely at the context of indigenous white settler relations in Australia. And I'm thinking here particularly of, in France, there has been a very interesting movement over the last couple of years, an activist movement that called themselves the Indigènes, or the natives of the Republic. And in this case, it's actually predominantly North Africans who are residing in the metropole, who are actually saying the ongoing legacies of, or the ongoing experience of colonisation are being felt in contemporary France. So this is not something that is reserved to settler colonies. This is something that actually is being felt in many supposedly post-colonial situations. So where does this lead me? I'm just going to finish by suggesting one of the things that I think is maybe a potentially useful way of trying to talk across, recognising that we are coming from very different places, but also recognising that as long as we are engaged with only talking to each other through a white intermediary, and this is something that came through very much at the ACROSA conference, that by debating which of us was properly a victim of colonisation, or how colonisation affected me worse than it affected you, that what ultimately happens is the white centre, as the privileged voice that oversees, doesn't ever get challenged. And this is what I actually want to call into question. I think that there is real political urgency for us to be able to speak across our differences, because that is the only way in which we can possibly shake up who gets to actually decide which of our claims get heard and which of our claims don't. And there I want to suggest that Avtar Brar's work on what she calls diaspora spaces is potentially opens up some interesting areas, and I'll very quickly explain what that is. What diaspora spaces, I mean, Avtar Brar is very conscious of the dangers of using the concept of diaspora. Yes, 20 seconds. So, recognising that it can be overly homogenising, recognising that we need to recognise the different experiences of privilege within diaspora experience. But one of the things that she does do is talk about the need to recognise a certain amount of native in each diasporan, and a certain amount of diasporan in each native. And I think that already, I mean, one of the big criticisms of, that I think is a really fundamental criticism of Harge's work when he talks about indigenous versus migrant, is that he fails to recognise that actually the indigenous identity is not something that has been so closed off and territorially bounded that it hasn't engaged with other communities, with other identities, and in a way that is much more internationalizing and globalizing. I think that actually it reinforces the whole colonial settler logic to talk about the indigenous person as trapped in a particular space to a particular territory, and the migrant as this movable but never belonging. I think that by opening up these ideas of the native and the diasporan as actually two sides of potential, that we all potentially have aspects of both in us, is actually potentially what James Clifford calls a new way of being a native, and maybe opens up new possibilities for all of us to actually question the racist politics the way that they currently operate in Australia. Okay, thank you.